This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, your host, hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices episode 95 was pre-recorded back in late November 2017 to air on December 24th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Happy holidays, everyone. We're not going to have a market wrap or post-game segment for the balance of 2017. We'll return to our usual show format on January 4th, 2018. Instead, today's entire show will be entirely dedicated to part one of our year-end special featuring Morgan Creek founder Mark Yusko, Alhambra Investments CIO Jeffrey Snyder, and Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman. I think you're really going to enjoy this five-part series, which in my opinion is the only level-headed, serious discussion that you'll find anywhere about how and why the U.S. dollar will gradually lose its position of prominence and hegemony over the global financial system, just as the British pound sterling fell from that position of prominence in the early 20th century. This series was originally conceived as a two-hour special, and the planned topic was simply a debate between the secular dollar bull view and the secular dollar bear view. Jeff Snyder and myself were slated to represent the dollar bull argument, while Mark Yusko and Luke Grohman were slated to argue the dollar bear case. Now let's dive into what were originally intended to be the opening arguments in this debate. Keep in mind that as we were recording this first part, we still thought we were setting up a two-hour debate format, dollar bear versus dollar bull. I'll be back after these initial arguments to explain why we ended up deciding off the air to reframe the rest of the series after realizing that we were all in violent agreement that the dollar's age of hegemony over the global financial system is actually ending. Joining me next on the program are Jeffrey Snyder, CIO at Alhambra Partners, Luke Grohman, founder of Forest for the Trees, and Mark Yusko, founder and fund manager for Morgan Creek. I'd like to thank you guys so much for the time and energy you've put into this project. It really means a lot to us and our listeners. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks for having me on.
Glad to be here.
Okay. Let's go ahead and dive right in here, guys. Our first order of business is I'd like to start with each of us sharing our view as to where we stand in the big picture story of the U.S. dollar's hegemony over the global financial system. In other words, I think all of us see that everything has to come to an end. The dollar can't last forever. Are we in the second inning and there's going to be another 100 years of the dollar serving as the world's global reserve currency? Or are we in the bottom of the ninth and it's all about to fall apart? Or is it something in between? I think if we each start with a perspective on that, and feel free at the same time, if you have any feedback for Jeff on the Eurodollar University content, feel free to express that as well. Luke Grohman, why don't we start with you?
Absolutely. Thank you, Eric. In terms of answering the question, where are we in terms of the dollar hegemony, I think we're much further along than most market participants realize. I would probably say in the later innings, certainly the last third of the game, maybe the eighth inning. The reason I say that is that given the euro-dollar system as it's structured, early on, if any nations or major parties wanted to move away from using the dollar for any number of reasons, ironically, what that moving away from the dollar would do would drive significant dollar strength. So ironically, accelerating moves to dump the dollar in global trade usage, which in the long run is the most bearish development for the dollar, in the near term is the most bullish development for the dollar. And so when we look back, we think beginning in 3Q14 was when you started to see a marked acceleration in dollar's share loss in global trade, and in particular in energy trade centered between China and Russia. And so we think things began to accelerate in 3Q14. And like we said, the process of moving away from the dollar or the dollar losing share in trade is a big positive for the dollar until it's not. And so we think it's a big positive part of this movie started in 3Q14. And then the until it's not part of this movie began in over a year ago now in 3Q16. And the reason we say that is because from 3Q14 until 3Q16, you saw rising dollar, rising LIBOR, and pretty traditional dollar strengthening cycle up to that point. Where it started, where it became non-traditional relative to what pretty much any market participant trading in markets today, or even alive today, was when in 3Q16, rising dollar, rising LIBOR drove a year-over-year decline in U.S. tax receipts, and therefore an increase in the U.S. deficit as a percent of GDP. And it did this before you had a major emerging market crisis. This was the first time the U.S.'s tax receipts declined before in a major emerging market crisis in a dollar tightening cycle in the post-Bretton Woods period. And so then when you combine that with what has become effectively a system that requires ad infinitum asset price appreciation in order to drive tax receipts for the U.S. government, it sets up beginning in 3Q16, where we started to get into late innings of this game, where not only are foreign creditors looking to move away from the dollar in trade usage for a number of reasons, but it also started to become a matter of national security for the U.S. government for the dollar to weaken. So I'll stop there and open up for questions or pass the baton onto the next gentleman.
Why don't we move on to Jeff Snyder next, just to get a contrast? And Jeff, in your case, let's just broaden the question a little bit to also the Eurodollar system, which you've taught us so much about in Eurodollar University. Is it going strong? Is it falling apart? Is it something in between? And where do you see the big picture for the dollar, as we just asked Luke?
I think all of us agree that the dollar system doesn't work. And it hasn't worked for a long time already, going back to 2007. So eventually something has to happen. And the question is, what has to happen and when? My position is that the dollar system, the supply of dollars in the global network of trade continues to be a problem, but it isn't a problem in a straight line. It's not like it's a straight line decay from where you can draw a singular line from 2007 to 2017. Instead, it's more of a intermittent type of thing where we have these alternating periods where things tighten up, then they loosen up relatively. But as we go through each of these periods, the system is worse off for having gone through each one. And so the last tightening episode starting in 2014 and lasting through 2016 was severe, especially in emerging markets like Brazil, Russia, and China, the BRICS, because that's where that part of the dysfunction was focused, more in FX and more into the Asian part of the system as it had evolved since 2007 in that direction. So from my perspective, nothing has really changed except the system continues to get weaker. And I think right now where we are is we're waiting for the next tightening event to start taking place. There's plenty of evidence that the system continues to decay, particularly with China and some of the other emerging markets. So, it doesn't add up to a bullish position necessarily. And I think that's one of the things I want to define is what exactly is a rising dollar. And it's not bullish. And I'm certainly not of the position that most dollar bulls take, which is that the dollar goes up because the U.S. is going to strengthen either economically, financially, or otherwise. And I think that's just not the case. And so if we couch these in terms of the euro dollar system and its continued decay, it's not a bullish thing, but I think the dollar continues to go up, at least for the next little while, because frankly, there is nothing there to take its place. So we're kind of stuck with it.
Mark Yusko, let's give you the last word on this question. Where do you think we are in this story? Are we still in the middle of the game as far as the dollar's role as the leading hegemonic currency in the global financial system?
We are still in the game. And, it's funny. I think we're going to have lots of disagreement later, but we do have pretty violent agreement here on the fact that the dollar system and being the sole world reserve currency is unlikely to persist. What's interesting thing about world reserve currencies is there have been lots of them over time. And, I always joke that Americans are like Notre Dame football fans. They remember a past that never was. And, Notre Dame football fans think we win all the time, which clearly we don't. I was down in Miami. That was horrible. And, Americans think that we've always been the world reserve currency for some reason, and we clearly haven't. It's only been since 1944. So what's interesting about that is the transition can last a long time. The sun never set on the British Empire for 70 years. They had the world reserve currency. They had the strongest navy. And then in 1913, they invaded Mesopotamia, incurred a bunch of debt. The pound sterling collapsed. The dollar ascended. We, 31 years later, became the world reserve currency. And then in 2013, we coincidentally, you know, invaded Mesopotamia, incurred a bunch of debt, and the, you know, dollar collapsed and the renminbi ascended. Well, that hasn't all happened yet, but I think it's on its way to happening. And when I look around the world, I think it's supremely clear that China has a plan. And, you know, for the last 50 years, their stated goal was a harmonious rise. Doesn't that sound poetic? It's beautiful. It's non-confrontational. And President Xi just changed that a couple weeks ago to global superpower by 2050. So they clearly have a goal, and they became a world reserve currency a year and a half ago. And we think they will become the world reserve currency at some point in the future. But that's what we're going to talk about over the next couple hours.
Well, and, you know, just to add my perspective to this, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the U.S. dollar is going to lose its status as the world's hegemonic reserve currency and dominant currency in the world in our lifetimes. It's just, I made the mistake about 10 years ago of thinking, because it was inevitable, that that meant that it was imminent. And of course, it wasn't imminent. And so I'm very, very fascinated to hear what we're going to talk about. I think just to bring our listeners up to speed, what we've agreed to do is, I was just starting to explain our intended two-week debate format when Luke and Mark called a timeout and said, look, if you want us to disagree strongly with somebody on the air, it's not going to be Jeff Snyder. They observed that all three of them are basically in violent agreement that the dollar's hegemony over the global financial system is slowly ending. The only real point of contention is that, as Luke put it in his opening argument, the global dollar shortage, which all three of our guests agree exists, is bullish for the dollar initially, but eventually you reach a point where it stops being bullish and the dollar starts to decline relative to other currencies. Jeff and I don't think we've reached that point yet. Mark and Luke think it already happened when the dollar index hit its recent high around 103. But frankly, our disagreement ends there. After discussing this off the air, we realized that a much more interesting topic for this series would be a four-way discussion as opposed to a debate, effectively analyzing the end game for the U.S. dollar as the world's global reserve currency. Now again, I want to be clear. None of us see this as a catastrophic crisis or an overnight event. Big ships take a long time to change course. And to this day, scholars argue about which decade marked the end of the pound sterling's hegemony over the global financial system. The dollar's fall from prominence will happen over a period of years, and it's not the end of the world. But it is a major monetary system transition that will have epic impacts not only on financial markets and investors, but also on the global economy and society as a whole. So we decided to go deep on this subject using the slide decks that each of our guests had originally prepared for our planned debate as talking points to frame a discussion about how the dollar's fall from prominence in the global financial system is likely to occur and what some of the major signposts along the way are likely to be. What quickly became apparent is that as we made this change in content, suddenly, instead of the 2 hours that we had planned, we wound up with more than 5 hours of total content. So let's go ahead and dive back into our conversation with our three guests. At this point, we're going to shift to Jeff Snyder's slide deck. The remainder of this episode and all of the second episode will be dedicated to an open conversation based on Jeff Snyder's slide presentation. The third and fourth episodes will be guided by Mark Yusko and Luke Grohman's slide decks, and the final episode will bring together our conclusions from all three guests about how the dollar endgame is likely to go down, how long it will take, and what the landscape will look like after the dust settles when it's over several years into the future. Please be sure to download Jeff Snyder's slide deck before listening to the rest of this episode, because it will be the basis for the first major discussion between our three expert guests. Registered Macro Voices listeners will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the download instructions in this episode's description on our homepage. Jeff doesn't mention slide numbers in every single instance, but if you follow along with the slide deck, you'll find that the conversation basically follows that outline. Be sure to stay tuned at the end of this conversation when I'll be back to announce the accelerated release schedule for the remaining episodes over the holidays. So with this new agenda in place, let's continue without further ado. Alhambra Investments CIO Jeffrey Snyder will lead the conversation for the remainder of this episode. Let's make this, gentlemen, as interactive as possible. Let's not have Jeff just give us a lecture, but by all means, please interrupt. And Jeff has gone way out of his way in email to ask me to please encourage you guys to be as critical as possible. Don't try to be polite. If you disagree, let him know. With that, Jeff, why don't you take it away? I think one of our listeners posed a question that I really think sets you up for this, which is it possible that this Eurodollar system, which so many people don't understand, that's created so much money supply for so many years, could eventually break down and go into reverse and start causing the destruction of money supply that people don't understand? So that's probably a good way to set you up. Go ahead and take it from there and reference your slide deck as much as you like. And by all means, Mark and Luke, speak up if you disagree and want to argue any of the points that Jeff brings up.
We won't be shy.
Well, let me start out by agreeing with Mark, just to put it on the wrong foot here. You know, Mark, you said something that I think is very important. Is that you know, there have been several different currency reserve currency formats throughout the years, and a lot of them don't really last very long, and they don't end all at once. There is usually a transition period between what was and what is. And even if you think about the Bretton Woods system, in my view, it only lasted 16 years until 1960. The formation of the London Gold Pool in 1960 was a default event, certainly from the original terms of Bretton Woods. And so between 1960 and 1971, it wasn't as if the, you know, President Nixon all of a sudden closed the goals window on Bretton Woods and that was it. There was a transition period over actually more than 11 years, so that by 1971, what happened was almost inevitable. And so I think that's where we are now, is we're in a transition period between what was and what is. And the reason is, as Eric alluded to from the listener feedback, is that we had this massive offshore, hidden, however you want to term it, Eurodollar system that for decades grew and grew and grew, not just quantitatively, but qualitatively, and how it actually interacts and how it actually works among different parts of the system until 2007. And once 2007, everything that happened then, the system hasn't been able to function since then. And that's the reason why, you know, central banks keep doing various stimulus programs, whatever. They never seem to get anywhere. They never seem to work, is because they're quantitatively and qualitatively ill-suited to the actual monetary system. And so I think that's what that's left us with, is this so-called rising dollar, which is really nothing more than a short squeeze. If you want to put it in terms of a synthetic short position, the world has a synthetic short position in U.S. dollars. And that's easy enough to do and easy enough to handle when the supply of dollars is free and easy, flexible and dynamic, as it had been up until 2007. Starting August 9th, 2007, it was no longer the case. And as I said earlier, it's been intermittently a problem ever since. And so it's a problem that hasn't been fixed. And we go through these episodes of tightening and relative loosening.
Yeah, I guess, Jeff, I have one question on that you know, you brought up earlier as well, which is that a dollar rise does not necessarily mean that the dollar is positive or that it's bullish. You know, that really could just be the race to the bottom. The other guys, particularly the euro and the yen, are weakening faster. And that's one of the perspectives I really come to, is that demographically the developed world is basically hosed. You know, they have bad demographics, we have too much debt, and therefore we're stuck and mired in this deflation. And the only way out is through massive devaluation of the currency. And clearly the leaders in that are the Japanese, but the Europeans are getting pretty good at it. And ours, by comparison, we're just not quite as good at devaluation as those guys are. Any validity to that perspective?
I would agree with it in terms of how the system actually operates on a risk return basis. Before 2007, it operated as if there was no risk at all. In other words, you know, you could add volume. Any bank grew exponentially because the perception was that there was no risk to anything. And that's how we got a subprime mortgage problem. That's how we got an EM junk debt problem. Was the fact that everybody just grew, didn't care how. The name of the game was get bigger. And so that's what happened. Everybody got bigger. And starting in 2007, we started to have an inward reflection of what exactly was going on in this system. And I think that's part of it, Mark, is that part of it was, you know, there's a lot of inherent contradictions here. This is not a risk-free system. In fact, it may be a return-free system. And that there's a lot of risks that were not appreciated before then.
I guess my question on it, Jeff, is you know, the point you made about the London gold pool, the setup of that in 1960 was really the first default under Bretton Woods, and of course made 71 inevitable, which I thought was a really interesting point, because your ensuing point that the euro dollar system began to break down in August of 07, we've talked in our research that what has happened post 08, there's been a lot of analogs to that period of time, where if the first default under Bretton Woods was the setup of the London gold pool, the first default of the euro dollar system was 07, 08, when you had to take rates to zero and you had to grow balance sheets the way you did at the Fed and around the world. And so if you say, all right, well, you know, the 1960 to 1967 period was the first default, and say that that's akin to the 07 through, call it 2013 period, you know, then of course, beginning in 67, 68 timeframe, the U.S.'s creditors at that point were in the EU, and they began to look at guns and butter, what LBJ was doing and how Vietnam was going. And they said, we're done. We're done here. Give us our gold. And so then you had, you know, sort of the breakdown of the London gold pool, and, you know, a lot of gold flowed out of the U.S. at an accelerating pace to try to sort of hold that system up before Nixon closed the gold window. That closing of the gold window by Nixon was going bankrupt slowly and then going bankrupt all at once. And so, you know, I look at, again, sort of to this time around, 08 to 013 was sort of the London gold pool timeframe. And then in early 13, you know, after the Fed came out in 3Q12 and said, we're going to QE forever, then you had in 1Q13, China, who is the creditor this go around, showed up and said, we're done here, give us our gold. And you saw this massive run on physical gold out of London, all most of it going east from as best we can tell. And so I guess long-winded way of introducing the question, which is, if we think about 60, the London gold pool set up in 60 as 07, and the breakdown of the gold pool as 2013, do you think, A, do you think that's a valid comparison? And B, do you think we could get sort of that same sort of binary denouement of the whole situation where we get over a weekend, a Sunday night surprise or something?
Yeah, I think the analog is a good analogy. In general terms, I think there's a big difference, though, that we have to consider. During the 1960s, there was an alternate settling mechanism for Bretton Woods that had developed in the 50s, and that's what the Eurodollar was. The Eurodollar was a way of global liquidity, or providing global liquidity, so that in many ways, central banks could circumvent Bretton Woods. I mean, the rise of the Eurodollar system in the 60s had as much to do with foreign central banks circumventing Bretton Woods as it did with banks increasing their balance sheet. And so what I mean by that is there was, you know, 1971 happened. There was already an alternate means in place operating for a very long time in which all of the global participants were used to. So that when Nixon ended convertibility, I don't want to say it was a seamless transition, but in operational terms, it was, because there was already another mechanism in place in operation at the time. And I think that's what's missing here. We don't have another settlement mechanism that is actually in place and operating right now that could replace the Eurodollar. I think that various parties want to do something about that, but they're running into problems because you look at Western central bankers and Western officials in particular, and none of them even think there's a problem. And so if you're China, you're essentially negotiating with yourself, because, you know, you're not going to get Janet Yellen to the table to talk about replacing the dollar, because she doesn't think there's a dollar problem at all. And there isn't any other kind of settlement mechanism available at this moment that would allow for something to happen tomorrow. Any kind of weekend surprise would be catastrophic, because there's no mechanism currently in place to allow that to happen. So that's why I think that we're more earlier in the process of transition between reserve currencies than later.
Jeff, why don't we go ahead and dive into your slide deck? Give us a tour of what's on your mind with the bull argument. And I guess let's change our terminology. It's not a bull argument. Let's describe the reasons why you think the dollar may appreciate relative to other currencies as part of the process of its demise, which is what I think we're really talking about here.
Yeah, and I think a better terminology would be short squeeze. It's sort of a dollar short squeeze. And again, you know, we think about the euro dollar development from things all the way back as some things like bankers' acceptances. It's essentially a short dollar system where every participant in it is short the dollar. They roll over funding every day, whether it be in repo or unsecured or in FX or however it's done, essentially everybody around the world needs dollars and therefore they're short of them. And so when the dollar supply becomes less malleable, less pliable, less dynamic, it becomes a problem for certain parts of the system being able to roll over their commitments. And what happens when you have to roll over your commitment and it's not as easy to do so, the price of it goes up. And in terms of currencies, a short squeeze in the dollar means a rising dollar or a falling counterpart currency. So I think a good place to start to really kind of describe and put some real world examples to this process is Russia. You know, one of the things about central banks going back for the last couple of years, and this was, you know, Ben Bernanke's supposed to be his great legacy, was opening up central banks to become more transparent in how they conducted monetary policy. And some central banks take that to heart, some central banks don't. In 2014, the Russians, for example, the Central Bank of the Russian Federation, very explicitly and very publicly started auctioning off euro dollars and euros, which in this case would be euros. And the reason they did so was because that Russian banks were having trouble securing dollar funding primarily in the second half of 2014. And so essentially what the Russian Central Bank was doing was becoming a redistribution point for local Russian banks that were being shut out or couldn't afford terms of euro dollar financing. They were, in essence, being squeezed out of the dollar market. And as that was happening, of course, the Russian ruble started to devalue because, again, the price of participating in a short squeeze is you have to pay up for it. So the Russian ruble in the second half of 2014 and throughout 2015 and 2016 underwent severe crisis. The devaluation was severe because the dollar shortage had become severe for them. They were not alone in that position. In fact, it became a widespread thing. We go to Brazil, for example. Brazilian real had started devaluing all the way back in the 2011 dollar crisis, but that really came to a head in 2013. The Banco do Brasil, the Brazilian central bank, chose to deal with their dollar squeeze a little bit differently, or a lot differently, really, than the Central Bank of Russia. Rather than deplete their reserves, they decided they would go into essentially a dollar subsidy. They're technically not swaps, but a lot of people think of them as dollar swaps. Without really getting into too much of the details, what the central bank essentially had to do was to subsidize Brazilian banks borrowing in the euro dollar market to make it cheaper so that they could borrow more on the euro dollar market to bring dollars into Brazil. And what happened was in 2013 and especially 2014, they did so many of these swaps or these synthetic swaps that it threatened to use up all of Brazil's reserves. I think at the worst part, it was about 120 billion in non-deliverable swaps that was compared to about, I think it was 380 billion in Brazilian reserves. So as soon as they cut off the subsidy in late 2014, the Brazilian real, the bottom essentially fell out from it. Without the subsidy, there was no way for Brazilian banks to easily obtain dollars on the dollar market. And of course, the short squeeze hit Brazil.
So Jeff, this is Mark. I just wanted to come back on your point on, I think it was slide 5 on the ruble. It seems to coincide pretty nicely with the collapse in oil prices. Is that a contributing factor to the dramatic weakness in the ruble? Was it just that they couldn't get enough dollars because the export of oil just wasn't bringing in enough revenues?
It's both. I think it's a self-reinforcing thing, especially for a country like Russia, because Russia depends on the oil business to obtain a lot of their dollars. And so there's a mercantilist component to it as well. If you're selling oil for fewer dollars, you know, it makes it much more difficult for you in a position of a borrower where the banks who are lending you dollars for all sorts of other things, you become much more riskier of a borrower in their eyes. So yeah, it's a self-reinforcing thing for especially Russia. But it isn't just the problem of demand, it's the problem of supply. So it puts Russia at the very front of the risk list. In other words, if you're a euro dollar bank supplying dollars on the global market and you're having trouble with, you know, whatever reason it is, particularly that you're cutting back your dollar business, you're going to come back from Russia right at the start because they're one of the most riskier aspects of the euro dollar business. And so it makes sense to charge them more to continue doing dollar business with them. And the oil price is definitely a big part of that.
You know, it's interesting, Jeff, you know, and Mark, this is Luke, of course. When you look back to September, we put this in our slide deck, which we can touch on later. But if you look back at the actual timing of events, it's kind of interesting. And it's to me, it hints to motive. So I'd love to get your thought on it, Jeff or Mark, of So if you go back to August of 2014, actually back even to May of 14, you had the Holy Grail gas and energy deal signed between China and Russia. It was rumored that that deal was going to be done in non-dollars, but no proof of that. It was later proven to be the case. In August of 2014, Putin announced that they wanted to start moving away from the dollar in oil trade because the dollar's monopoly in global energy trade was damaging their economy. And what's kind of interesting is, and we wrote about this at the time, is at this point, oil's still $100 a barrel. And then all of a sudden, by late September, with oil still $96 a barrel, $95 a barrel, Russia's having dollar shortages. Russia was still, and they weren't the only ones, Venezuela, Ecuador, a couple others. You have three oil, major oil exporters that are running still current account surpluses in the low to mid single digits at this point, starting to run into dollar shortages. And it was, I think, an underappreciated point at the time that basically, if you're an oil exporter, you're only selling in dollars, you're running a current account surplus. And so if you're only selling in dollars, in theory, there's only two explanations for that, for those dollar shortages that began to pop up well before price of oil crashed, which was number one, you know, Russia and other places got dramatically more corrupt in the 3 months versus the 3 months before, or they were starting to sell energy at a accelerating rate in non-dollar terms. And as a result, you were seeing you were getting $100 in before, now you were getting whatever, $90, $80, whatever the mix was. And at that point, then you started to see some of the devaluations, et cetera. I guess I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Luke, I think there's a third option there. The third option is dollar supply. And if you look at the rising dollar of 2014, it didn't just begin in 2014. That's why I bring in Brazil. There was dollar problems going back to 2011. And a lot of that came to a head in the taper summer of 2013, which was as much a currency crisis as anything else, because that's where banks really started to ask questions about their exposures overseas. And I think there's a couple of reasons for it. A lot of the assumptions that prevailed in the dollar business after 2008, 2009 were tested and challenged by 2012. And one of the assumptions was, and you see this in a lot of the dollar figures, okay, the developing world, the US and the European economies are going to struggle. And there was a very big consensus that that was the case. And so a lot of the dollar business moved toward Asia and the emerging markets in the intervening years. And the reason was because everybody thought, well, China would just return to growth. The emerging markets are always going to be emerging markets. And so there's relatively less risk in those places. And so dollar business grew in Asia as it shrank in Europe. By 2013, however, it became clear, or at least it started to dawn on some people, that maybe that wasn't the case. Maybe the emerging markets were not going to go back to normal. Maybe China was going to have continued economic problems. And so it wasn't as much of a risk return scenario as thought prior. And so when all of those things started to be reevaluated in 2013, that's when you start seeing more and more currency devaluations as a result of global Eurodollar banks pulling back, not only in their own balance sheet, but also becoming more preferential about their counterparties. And so, again, that's why I referenced Brazil. Yes, Brazil has a heavy oil exposure, but they're not exclusively an oil exposure like Russia is. In Brazil, they started doing their swaps in May of 2013, long before any of that other stuff. So there was clearly a dollar problem in Brazil going back to, I would say, 2011, but really it amplified in 2013. And so to get back to your point, Luke, I think there's a third option here.
Well, I was going to say, it's Luke again, just a follow-up question. Why do you think the Fed went from September 2012, we're going to re-up QE again, to all of a sudden less than, I guess, whatever, early May, late April 2013, we're going to taper, right? Because the consensus at that time was, hey, there's no ill effects from this. We can do this as much as we want. Was that political? To me, it's just always been fascinating that the Fed says in September of 2012, we're going to QE forever. And then in, you know, February, March, China shows up in London and starts buying everything that's not bolted down in terms of gold. And all of a sudden, you see an inversion, an unprecedented inversion in gold forward rates. And you see, you know, effectively a run on physical gold take place throughout the world. And then in May, the Fed goes, okay, we're going to taper. Why do you think they reversed themselves so quickly?
Yeah, I think that was a big shock to a lot of people because they were in, you know, go back to 2012, the Fed was kind of panicky. I mean, the whole idea of open-ended QE was that reason. They wanted to help the market psychologically at least, didn't do anything monetarily, but psychologically, I think they wanted to let the markets know that they would at least stand behind them for a long period of time. And then just a few months later, I mean, you know, in February 2013, you had a speech by Fed Governor Jeremy Stein that said, hey, you know, there's some things wrong here. This reach for yield thing is real. And not only was it just reach for yield speech that he gave, he also referenced collateral swaps with junk debt. So I think the Fed kind of scared itself on both sides. In 2012, the Fed was concerned about the economy falling into recession so soon after the Great Recession. So they acted. But by early 2013, things look a lot better. And they started to notice all these kind of irregular financial characteristics, including the stock market that just went insane that year. So I think it was contradictory position where they were panicking in 2012, and then by 2013 they had reevaluated everything. And I think it didn't have anything to do with the Fed as much as it did the Eurodollar. And I think the Eurodollar system had started to go back toward reflation at the end of 2012 as the Fed was just starting QE3. And so coincident timing there.
It's Mark. I think the other thing that people forget is, you know, we had some new actors come on the scene. You know, with their bazooka. You know, you had Japan with Abe-san getting elected in November of 12, and then you had Kuroda-san whip out the bazooka and say, you know, we are going all out. We are going to QQE like nobody's business. And you know, what's amazing about Japan is, you know, in 2007-08, they said they were going to trim their balance sheet. They were going to trim the Bank of Japan balance sheet from about 26% of GDP. And they did to about 20% of GDP. The stock market went down about 55%. They had a recession. Things were ugly. So then finally, Abe-san comes in 4 or 5 years later and says, yeah, we got to fix this. I think they had 4 prime ministers in 4 years before Abe-san came in. And remember, he had gotten kicked out, you know, with his stomach virus. Interesting topic for another day before that. And So he comes in, and I think that changed things, and we had that kind of false recovery, so to speak, because there's a lot of money being injected. Now, I actually have a thesis that all of this is being coordinated by Ms. Lagarde. We'll come back to that, I'm sure, later. But I want to jump back to one other thing that came up that I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, but I think it's important. I have this thesis that if we go back to what Jeff, you made about the gold window being shut in 71, you know, I have a thesis that's what this whole thing is about. And it's why I come to my worldview of the dollars, that the petrodollar system was created in 1971. We cut a deal with the Saudis. We said we would protect them. They said, well, we said we'd protect them as long as they denominated all currency transactions globally of oil in dollars. And every single time a country has threatened to denominate oil or gas transactions in another currency, we attack them. So Iraq tried it, Libya tried it, now Russia was trying it. Now we didn't attack Russia per se physically like Iraq and Libya, but we certainly did all the sanctions coordinated with Europe in March. And I think that had a lot to do with what was going on. And I always say that everything always comes back to oil. You know, that's been the currency of choice to back up the fiat since we closed the gold window. So I think oil becomes a very important topic as we think about the future going forward.
I think it's a really good point, Mari. It's interesting. I had a good friend of mine was at a conference overseas about, I guess it was about almost 2 months ago now, where a very wealthy Chinese businessman stood up and publicly said that if Saddam or Gaddafi had nuclear weapons, both of them would still be alive, which is very, very interesting to hear, right? From in terms of somebody who, you know, if you're a billionaire in China, you have to be connected to the government. And then number two, to say that publicly in the United States would be considered, to your point, sort of down the rabbit hole, but it's elsewhere in the world, because this was in a European location that this Chinese businessman said this, like it was sort of taken as given. It you know, we can certainly touch on this, you know, later in the presentation. I certainly get into it later in mine, but I think from some of what we were seeing in these currency markets as you got into 12 and 13 was geopolitical in nature, right? As of the Russians do have nukes, and so you can't do what you did, and so you have to try to use a different weapon, which, you know, the dollar's been a remarkably effective weapon over time.
Okay, if we go back to the slide deck and start with pick back up on slide number 11. I think what it shows us, and this, by the way, it's the Russian ruble mapped against the U.S. TIC data, the foreign official holdings of treasuries. And what it tells us is that the foreign officials sector, which is foreign central banks and foreign treasuries, foreign finance ministries, they started selling treasuries, or at least using their reserves to help with their dollar supply issues in 2013 as things started to become more problematic in that case. They were somewhat successful in at least that they bought some time, which is, again, what's what central banks do. No central bank expects to run up against a chronic issue. When they intervene in any market, they do so with the intention that it would be temporary. And so I think that was the expectation in 2013, was that central banks would intervene and then the problem would go away, except it didn't go away. In fact, in 2014, for various reasons, and we can get into those various reasons, and maybe there's geopolitical considerations in those as well. And I think we do have to consider them as certainly as perhaps unintended consequences, or maybe intended consequences, you know, either way. But by 2014, the dollar problem became that much worse. But global central banks, especially those in certain locations where the pressure was most acute, like Brazil and Russia, they had already done what they had done, and they had no ammunition left to offset what was coming, which was the rising dollar, the real short squeeze. So 2013 was just the warm-up act, the warning for the real event that happened in 2014, 15, and in early part of 2016. And the way that the central banking and the foreign official sector tried to deal with those problems was by mobilizing reserves in various fashions. And I think that's what's important about looking at both Russia and Brazil, is that there's more than one way to do this. If you have a dollar problem, you don't just need to sell your treasuries. You can go through the repo process like the Bank of Russia did. You can go through a derivative process like the Bank of Brazil did. And I think when we get down to it coming up, you know, we don't really know what the Chinese did, but we know that they probably did some of both of those things.
I was just going to ask, you know, in terms of, you know, specific to Russia, as I look at this chart, you definitely watch them sell their treasury position down. It was really interesting, as one thing we noticed in that 13-14 time that was really different, which was that unlike in, say, 2008 when oil prices collapsed, Russia sold some treasuries and they sold gold, the gold reserves as well. In 1998, you saw when they had problems, same story, sell treasuries, sell gold. In 2013, 2014, something really interesting happened, which was they sold treasuries, but they bought gold and they kept buying gold. And it was really interesting at the time. You know, there was a talk in gold markets that the Russians would have to sell their gold reserves, and that was negative for gold. And they did the exact opposite, that A, that people were expecting, B, that you would intuitively expect if they're short dollars, the last thing you'd expect them to do is buy gold. And then also very different than what they had done in prior oil price collapses in both 08 and in 98. So I guess, you know, why do you think they did that? And, you know, is it possible that speaks to some of the geopolitical side of some of what was happening that Mark raised?
I think there has to be. I mean, look, I mean, the Russians, the Chinese, the Brazilians, all these other peoples outside the United States, as we talked about before, they realize what's going on here. They're at the wrong end of all of this. And so they have a very good intuitive sense that things are not working. And for them, the things are really not working. So there has to be some kind of geopolitical backlash against the system that doesn't work. Whether that manifested in the gold, I can't answer that question because I don't really know. Maybe that is an important thing. But from what I would tell you about
this. But you'd agree it was sort of strange.
Oh, absolutely. But there's a lot of things that, you know, that changed in that time period, which is what you're alluding to. I think a lot of it was because there was a shock there. The shock was that the emerging markets were not as immune as people thought, and that the people in those emerging markets, officially in those emerging markets, had a front seat to that shock that Western central bankers or Western monetary officials are still in denial about. You know, Janet Yellen doesn't think there is a dollar problem out there. Well, yeah, I think the Russians know that there is a dollar problem because they have lived through it. You know, the ruble crisis was a massive wake-up call. You know, that stuff was coming in 2013. You had the sense that there's something was very wrong there. And that somebody on the inside of the Central Bank of Russia would have knowledge that, you know, this is going to be bad. This is probably not going to be good. We need to do something. And so it would not surprise me if that was part of what happened there, because they thought, well, hell, we're going to get killed here. But how long do we want to keep going through this? You know, and that's the disconnect, I think, between us and the rest of the world. People in the United States and Europe have a sense of things that is badly skewed. The dollar is manifestly a huge problem, and we don't know it, though. And I think part of that is a privilege of being the dollar issuer. Well, not the dollar issuer, but being in that denomination. There's a privilege there that has essentially kept us in a sort of bubble about the consequences of the dollar's failure. So, Luke, I wouldn't be surprised if that was a geopolitical thing where foreign officials are saying to themselves, this just doesn't work. And we know it doesn't work.
Jeff, I'd like to throw a question in myself, which is, well, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, I was reading a lot of people who made an argument that I thought was very persuasive at the time. They said, look, here's what's going to happen someday. China and Russia and Japan, who are huge, huge holders of U.S. treasuries, are going to sell them off, and it is going to utterly collapse the U.S. treasury market. We're going to see runaway yields on treasuries to 15% because it's going to be a crisis. What's crazy to me is it happened the way they predicted, and the opposite seems to have occurred in terms of treasury yields. How is that possible?
Well, because it didn't happen the way they predicted. No, I mean, and then we're going to get into this, at least I want to get into this a little bit later if we have time, is that the Chinese can't just sell treasuries. They can't, because the PBOC's balance sheet, at the time, 3/4 of their balance sheet was foreign assets. So just in terms of simple accounting, you sell the asset side down, you have to sell the liability side down. So that's exactly what the Chinese did in 2014, is they mobilized their foreign reserves at first and allowed the asset side of the central bank balance sheet to decline, which, as we know from all the quantitative easing out there, at least what quantitative easing was supposed to be, amounts to quantitative tightening. And so the level of bank reserves, and if you want to just skip ahead, we can do that right now.
That's okay. If it's coming, let's save it for the right point. I just wanted to get to that topic before we're done today.
It's fine. You know, the dollar is the basis of so many central banks. Their monetary system in China is predicated on the dollar. And so selling down U.S. treasuries or U.S. dollar balances has the effect of tightening Chinese money. And that's exactly what happened. Bank reserves in 2015 declined by some 3 trillion RMB, which is an enormous decline. So there was direct economic and financial consequences to that happening, and which is essentially the point. These countries are almost in a position of mutually assured destruction here. They can't just sell off their own dollar holdings because that would undermine their own currency. It would undermine their own monetary system. And so I think that's why we're getting into, to Luke's point and to Mark's point as well, the geopolitical concerns here is that, okay, the dollar system doesn't work, but we're stuck with it. So what the hell do we do? You kind of sympathize with their position because it's between a rock and a hard place. Now, my sympathy kind of ends because they were certainly on board with all this while it seemed to be working up until August 2007. So they kind of, they made the deal with the devil, and eventually the devil gets paid. And so the question is, how does the devil get paid and in what form? And so from where my perspective here, especially when we go through the Chinese stuff, is they don't, what is their choice? I mean, they have to work in almost behind the scenes to try to get something of a workable alternative, because they don't have an alternative today. They cannot go with today getting rid of the dollar. They can't ditch the dollar today. I think they would want to.
Doesn't that speak to the binary nature, in your opinion? Like, if there's going to be a change, it's going to have to be just by virtue of the fact that how much this is not working and how far away we still appear to be from a solution, right? I think of those things, and it's like, we're running out of gas in the plane and we're nowhere near a landing strip, right? So that doesn't imply that we're going to get to the landing strip. It implies like we're going to fall straight down. No.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's what scares me the most, is maybe the analogy is a little different. To me, the Chinese are increasingly desperate. If you look at what they've done in 14, 15, 16, 17, they do increasingly desperate things. And it's possible, get to your point about a binary option here, they get to the point where they say, screw it. You know what? We've resisted de-dollarizing as best we can because we don't think there's an alternative. Let's just do it. Let's just say tomorrow. I mean, because this isn't working, we're in a high risk position. So why don't we just say screw it? We've been waiting patiently for those idiots in America to get their house in order, for somebody to take control of the euro dollar system and do something about it. It's been 10 years already. It's clear that's not going to happen. So let's just start reevaluating everything we do in RMB. If they get to a point where they're desperate enough, maybe that happens. That is certainly a risk. That would be one of the worst risks, in my opinion, but that is certainly something that they might have to consider. They might just have to get to the point where they throw their hands up and say, screw it. There's nothing else we can do, so we're just going to do what we're going to do.
So we left off where? I'm thinking slide 11 or 12 in your deck. Let's continue.
Yeah, if we get back to slide 12, it's nothing more than calibrating tick with something that market-based. It shows that the dollar supply issue, the U.S. dollar 10-year swap spread, for example, which is an implied balance sheet capacity measure. It fits pretty well with what we see in the holdings or the net changes in holdings of U.S. treasuries, where there is an increasing shortage and how that's applied across the world. Slide 13 is just goes back even further into actual banking data. The tick provides U.S. banking cross-border liability balances. As you can see, exponential growth up until 2007, 2008. Since 2007, 2008, there's been absolutely no growth. Not only just no growth, it's more volatile in these three episodes and how there is no growth. And so when we start thinking about that in terms of China, there's a direct relationship between dollar inflows, or what people used to call or still call hot money, and the supply of euro dollars on the market. And the reason is, again, the Chinese monetary system is dollar-based. So when the Chinese bowed to international pressure in 2005 and allowed CNY to float, or at least partially float, that had the effect of allowing more dollars into the country, which the central bank responded to by raising the reserve requirement on banks. In other words, more dollars meant banks could create more RMB. The way you try to control that as a central bank in China is by increasing the required rate of reserves to lock up some of those recreated reserves so that it didn't become runaway inflationary. So, you know, it's a pretty good calibration, internal China to external China, because as CNY goes up, that's dollars flowing in. And then from 2014 forward, those are dollars flowing out. And the way in which the PBOC tried to deal with dollars flowing out was the opposite of the prior condition, which kind of makes sense, at least on the surface. If you have a problem of too many dollars and you raise the reserve requirement, if you have a problem of too few dollars, you lower it. At least that was the idea, but it didn't really work out that way. Now, slide 15 is just kind of a visual representation of how the Chinese system works. Slide 16, again, Chinese currency exchange rate and the amount of PBOC4 assets going onto the Chinese balance sheet, therefore underpinning the Chinese monetary system. Then you kind of get into the problems in 2014. If we get to slide 17, bank reserve growth, again, the way they chose to deal with the dollar supply issue in 2014 and 2015 initially was a very passive approach for several reasons. Part of it was the reform agenda that they adopted in 2013, which part of it was supposed to be to allow more market-driven conditions inside the system. So as the Chinese were dealing with their dollar problem by mobilizing their reserves in whatever fashion, some of it was swaps, some of it was repos, some of it was just selling U.S. treasuries, that had the effect of reducing the asset side of the PBOC's balance sheet, which, again, in simple central bank accounting, had the same effect of reducing the money side. They weren't going to print less actual currency, so they allowed the level of bank reserves to decline in the middle of 2015, toward the end of 2015. And it was a very severe amount. And that lines up in slide 18 with changes in the U.S. dollar.
Real quick?
Yep.
Just to ask a question. As I look at that chart, you know, it looks like you had very consistently, you saw the rise in PBOC Forex assets under, or, you know, moving in the same direction consistently with PBOC liabilities. And then beginning right in sort of whatever looks like third quarter of 15, you saw what appears to be the first time in at least 10 years, this a divergence, right, where liabilities rose and FX assets continued falling. What drove that?
I think that was the conscious choice by the central bank monetary policy to try to deal with their dollar issue passively. In other words, they would mobilize reserves as best that they could and allow the banking system itself, because what they did in starting in late 2014 is they reduced triple R. So even though the level of bank reserves would decline by about $3 trillion, the expectation was that the private internal RMB market would make up the difference by having less reserves locked up under statutory requirement. And so, and again, it's a simple idea that seems logical on its face, because if you're doing the opposite when the CNY is rising and dollars are flowing in, why wouldn't it work in the other direction? And the reason was, of course, that things don't work in a one-to-one basis. You know, we live in a reflexive world where if there's a dollar problem in China, that maybe Chinese banks internally aren't ready or willing to make up liquidity in RMB terms, even if you lower the RRR. In fact, I think that's what we saw. Even the bigger banks were reluctant to supply even RMB, even though that's exactly what the PBOC wanted them to do. So it was a failed policy. But I think it speaks to the way that they wanted to handle the dollar issue originally in 2014 and 2015 was very passively. They thought that they could just let the private market absolve or alleviate any of that difference. And therefore, they wouldn't have to get involved because, you know, central banks are always on the lookout for making problems worse. And that, you know, that happens a lot of places. You know, the discount window, the stigma associated with that in the United States. There's a lot of that goes on elsewhere, too. As the central bank gets involved, investors get nervous because they think, well, there's really a problem here. And so I think they kept out of the problem originally in 2014-15 because they didn't want to make it worse. And of course, it didn't work out so well in that direction. Yeah, which gets us to about slide 20, where we start to evaluate the different things the PBOC has done as the dollar shortage has manifested over those three years starting in 2014. And you go back to the original devaluation in early 2014, which shocked a lot of people. People were not used to CNY going in the other direction. And so there was a fundamental argument in the media and in various circles about what exactly was going on. And what we wrote about in March of 2014 was that this was, the manifestation of 2013 starting to become more serious. That China had a dollar problem on its hands. And what it was doing by expanding first in early 2014 by allowing their daily float to essentially double was it was allowing Chinese banks to more aggressively bid for dollars that were becoming short in supply for them. And so this was the setup for what became the rising dollar, which was, again, a short squeeze, essentially. China was starting to be squeezed on the dollar markets, and they were starting to pay up for the privilege of having to do that. Slide 21 shows us, again, the regularity of CNY's devaluation, which isn't a devaluation. It's, again, the short squeeze, which are the fingerprints and the telltale signs of the PBOC doing whatever it is they did. Unlike Brazil, unlike Russia, the People's Bank of China doesn't report much to the international community. On the IMF call sheets for their reserves, most of it is blank, especially memo item 4, where all the interesting stuff is, the swaps and short positions and whatnot. If you go onto their call sheet, there's nothing there. So they're doing something, we just don't know what it is they're doing. And I think the intention is, quite honestly, is, you know, they wanted to arrest the short squeeze as best they could along the way, except they were defeated every time because the dollar problem was bigger than their effort.
Jeff, was this tied to the injection of the $1 trillion in liquidity into the economy? I have this thesis that the global economy was slipping into recession in third quarter, fourth quarter of 15, into the first quarter of 16. You know, everybody looks out at that, you know, first couple of weeks of the markets in 2016. You know, U.S. market was falling off a cliff, down 14%. Things were looking dark. Oil prices had collapsed all the way to $26. The whole dollar trade around the world was drying up because the big asset was now not worth anything. And China put $1 trillion into the economy, I'll say, to save the world. And do you think any of this change in exchange rate was because of that?
Oh, I think that was it exactly. I think that was their panic attempt to try to get this thing to stop. I agree with you. That's the global downturn in at the end of 15 was the consequence of this dollar shortage. It was starting to hit a lot of places. You know, Brazil's economy collapsed completely. The Chinese economy, you know, people were starting to talk about, Jesus, is China going to have a hard landing? You can't have a hard landing in China. That just doesn't happen. And so that's exactly what happened.
Not before the 19th Party Congress, you can't. No way.
Exactly. There's no way that can happen without heads rolling. So, you know, they did the 2015 approach, which, you know, we're getting on the slide 22. That was the passive thing. They're trying to let things develop. They're trying to let the market happen. They've had to let the dollar problem manifest internally. They reduced the reserve requirement on big banks, and that didn't work. In fact, in many ways, it made it worse because I think a lot of the Chinese banks in particular were looking for help, and they realized they weren't getting it. And so that actually had an amplification effect on the negative side rather than a palliative effect. And so by 2016...
This is when Kuroda-san lost his mind, right?
Yes.
This is when Kuroda-san went to negative interest rates and just threw everything up in the air.
Right. January of 2016, they all panicked because they said, you know, this is really going in the wrong direction. And so right in, you know, that if we go to slide 23, where that blue line jumps is January 2016. And that was the PBOC opening up their liquidity spigots in RMB, which is what they had avoided throughout 2015 and 2014. Now, they didn't just flood the market with RMB. They did a targeted approach where they used primarily the MLF, or the Medium Liquidity Facility, something that they had just come up with in 2013, which meant they were primarily lending RMB on very generous collateral terms to the biggest banks, which was their intent. They wanted the biggest banks to then become the point of redistribution in RMB to the smaller banks, because they thought the bigger banks, well, at least if they're liquefied in RMB, that would help. They'll stop panicking, and then they'll be a little bit more picky about who they're lending RMB from there in the repo and in the interbank market. But overall, you could see, you know, 2015 the PBOC was passive. 2016 they said, screw this, we're going to do something. And it wasn't just in the RMB that they went in. They also did a massive fiscal stimulus in that January, where they rapidly increased fixed asset investment through state-owned enterprises. And so January 2016, as things really started to get bad, the Chinese authorities panicked. They did it fiscally, they did it monetarily, and the net result of that was it didn't really work. Now, I mean, it's debatable whether or not it did. You can argue that it did work in the fact that things stopped getting worse. You know, at the very least, that it didn't, you know, the market crash stopped. The economy started to stabilize globally, not just in China. And so, you know, on that limited basis, you can say, well, that worked. But in terms of what actually people expect out of these kinds of things, it didn't work because it didn't start a recovery. It wasn't like growth has been accelerating since early 2016. In fact, it's, at best, it's been flat. And not only that, though, China's dollar problem, which is, you know, my bigger point here, didn't stop. They did the big RMB expansion throughout 2016, they did the fiscal stimulus in 2016, and still they had a massive dollar problem, which kept the CNY devaluing all the way through the end of the year. So they're still intervening in dollars, even though it seems on the surface like things are getting better. And which brings us to 2017, which they have now either directly or indirectly have encouraged or ordered local Chinese banks to start to increase their dollar borrowing through Hong Kong. And again, you know, it goes back to something I said earlier. To me, that's a more desperate approach. Now, you start out 2015 in a very passive position. 2016, you panicked in sort of the traditional textbook way. You know, you do the monetary stimulus, you do the fiscal stimulus. And none of those things really work. Chinese economy doesn't really accelerate. And so in 2017, they do this kind of crazy ad hoc Hong Kong workaround that, to me, it sounds a lot more like Chinese officials that are increasingly desperate, because the dollar issue is not a temporary condition. It's a chronic thing.
If their problem is that they're short dollars, how is the solution shorting more dollars in Hong Kong? Is it just you know, a level of the desperation of just trying to buy some time? I mean, am I thinking about that right?
Yeah, you are. You know, again, that's you know, when Brazil did it in 2013, I said that they're toast, because it's insane is what it is. Because what you look at what the Brazilians did through their swap program is they essentially incentivized local Brazilian banks to go even more short the dollar into the teeth of a short squeeze, which just sounds like insanity. But, you know, again, the reason they did it, because Banco was in denial about the dollar problem. They thought it was a temporary issue. If you look at it from their perspective of just trying to buy time, it sort of makes sense. You think, well, I'm going to get the Brazilian banks to go more short for another year, and in a year's time, this will all be something in the past. We won't have to worry about it. Except that wasn't what happened. As a chronic problem, you've actually made it that much worse. You've put yourself in a worse position. And so I guess back to, I think, what we're going to talk about with you guys is, the Chinese know that they're moving in the wrong direction here. They're not moving toward a solution. They're getting deeper and deeper and deeper involved in this because they have to. And the reason I think that they have to is there's no alternative right now. There is no alternative to the dollar system. They have no choice but to participate in it, and to participate in it on the terms that are set by the dollar system itself. And so, you know, again, from the Chinese perspective, it's got to make you mad.
Or they can change it, can't they? I mean, maybe that's the whole point of this whole thing about, hey, we're going to denominate oil transactions in renminbi going forward, and we're going to buddy up with Russia and other markets in Africa. We're going to start denominating not in dollars, but in yuan. I mean, does this just accelerate that whole process?
Yeah, and let's skip ahead to 27 here. I don't know.
That was my thought exactly, is, you know, for what you said to be true, Jeff, if that was really true that they were trying to do that, well, then they would also be taking some steps to solve the problem that there's no alternative to the dollar. Well, look at what they're doing. They're doing everything they possibly can to try to create alternatives to conducting what oil is the biggest commodity in terms of dollar flow. I shouldn't say dollar flow, monetary amount presently denominated in U.S. dollars. If the flow of oil could be persuaded by the efforts of various nations to not be denominated in dollars, that changes the world global financial picture bigger than anything else, because it is the most traded and largest dollar amount commodity of anything that's traded internationally anywhere.
If you're China, you're a net creditor to the world, with the exception of commodities. You're importing, off the top of my head, I think the number is $600 billion a year in commodities. Maybe it's $900 billion. It's a big number. But if you can reduce that bill for yourself by changing the terms of that trade, then that's another way you buy yourself time. Instead of just the levers that they've been pulling since 2014 that you've highlighted so eloquently here, Jeff, all of a sudden, you have a whole second lever where you can go to Russia, or you can go to OPEC or your copper suppliers, et cetera, and change the terms of trade. We've highlighted, you know, by looking at the gold oil ratio, right? If you expand the gold oil ratio, then if you're China, your oil bill drops. And if your oil bill drops, your current account surplus rises. And if your current account surplus rises, then you buy yourself time in all of this.
Luke, you're exactly right. Now, I was in Hong Kong in January, and your number's right. The $900 billion is the right number. You go back to January of this year, everyone, and I am not exaggerating when I say everyone, except maybe the people on this phone call, but everyone I know thought that the renminbi had to collapse. It had to devalue, not this 2, 3%. I love when China moves their currency 2 or 3%, people call it a devaluation. The yen moves by 40%, and that's sound monetary policy.
Right. What a world we live in.
It's just absolutely comical. And so, but I was at this meeting of Merrill Lynch puts on a meeting every January and invites their biggest clients in Asia to come to Hong Kong for 2 days. And everybody has to give their best idea. And it was actually an extraordinary 2 days. What was extraordinary to me, the range of ideas was cool, but what was really amazing is, to a person, and these are people who trade hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars in Asia, most of them located in China, but some in Singapore and other places in Tokyo, but they were, to a person, bullish on the renminbi and bearish dollar. And that's how I kind of came away this year with my 10 surprises, being bearish on the dollar, and everybody thought I was an idiot. I took such grief on Twitter, and you know, everybody ganged up on me and said I was just a dork.
But I was with you, Mark.
It was these. yes, right. You were my sole friend on Twitter.
I was right with you, bud.
And, I know. And what was amazing was these were smart people. And the point that a number of them made, which I'd love your opinion, Jeff, because you have obviously done the deepest dive on this, is they said that it really does come down to what Luke was just saying about the current account surplus. Said a strong economy, and they all said that the economy in China was much stronger than people think. And there's this great, it's like Li Kai Kuang, I can never pronounce the guy's name, Li Kai Kang index that Bloomberg put together. And it tracks things that they can observe, right? They say the government's lying about their data, so we're going to create our own. And they put together this thing on export prices and import prices and electricity usage and oil imports and all these things that they could track. And it actually came out that the Chinese economy was actually growing closer to 11% instead of 7. So they were lying. They were just understating. But they all said that the economy was stronger than people think, that they actually had their recession in 2015 that nobody knows about because no one's ever going to admit that we had one. and that the currency was going to be stronger, not weaker. That just seemed like blasphemy back in January. And now we look and we see it's exactly what happened in 2017. So I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Well, I want to get back to what you guys are saying about the Chinese position. If you go to slide 27, you know, that's exactly what they're doing. I mean, if you're between a rock and a hard place, you got to do whatever you can. And what they've been doing this year has been some of it extraordinary. The thing about Hong Kong is, I think, a high risk kind of a workaround rather than something a more well-positioned central bank might undertake. And again, I don't know for a fact, and nobody knows if it was, you know, is this PBOC directing local Chinese banks to borrow dollars through Hong Kong? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. I think it's a fair bet that they are probably being subsidized by forward cover in that respect. But regardless, what do you do if you're China? Well, one of the things you do is you try to increase the dollar supply as much as you can. So one of them is go through Hong Kong. You try to stabilize the currency exchange to try to entice dollar suppliers back into your country. Again, speaking to the current account thing, you want to get that hot money, which is to me is a bad term, but either way, you want to get hot money back flowing into China. So you stabilize the currency. You also go into the Eurobond market. Was it last month or the month before? Chinese federal government borrowed on the Eurobond market for the first time in 13 years. And it was a very minimal flotation. And the reason they did that was nothing more than to set a very low price for any Chinese corporates, hint financial corporates, that might follow into the Eurobond market. So if you can't get money from the bank part of the segment, you go into the bond part of the euro dollar market. They also opened up their FICC business or the securities business for the first time in 20 years.
That sounds like the Tesla strategy.
Now, this was such a great conversation that it was hard to choose a place to cut it off. But believe it or not, we're only halfway through the conversation our guests had over Jeff Snyder's slide deck alone. Here's the release schedule for the rest of the series, which was designed to give you plenty of Macro Voices content to listen to over the holidays. This first episode was released on December 24th. Part 2 will be released one day later on December 25th and will include the remainder of our conversation based on Jeff Snyder's slide deck. Part 3 will air at our regularly scheduled Thursday time slot on December 28th, when we'll dive into Mark Yusko's slide deck and the beginning of Luke Groman's slide deck. Then, on New Year's weekend, we'll be releasing Part 4 on December 30th, where we'll wrap up our conversation about Luke Groman's slide deck and start to move into our conclusions as to how this is all going to go down, how long it will take, and what the world's going to look like after the dust settles. And then finally, Part 5, the final segment in the series, will air as the feature interview segment on our regularly scheduled, normal format Macro Voices podcast on Thursday evening, January 4th. This special series was originally conceived as only two parts and was enabled directly by generous donations from our listeners. When we discovered that doing justice to the material would require 5 full hours of content, needless to say, we overspent our production budget considerably. So if you're able to make a donation to help us defray our production expenses this holiday season, it will be greatly appreciated, and it will make possible for us to bring you even more special content in the coming year. We also urgently need your help rating and reviewing Macro Voices on iTunes, because these ratings control our ranking in the business podcast directory, which is very important for growing the show, which helps us get better and better feature interview guests for your listening pleasure. To rate and review Macro Voices, simply open the iTunes application on your computer and click on the search box at the top right. Choose Store, and then type Macro Voices into the search box. Then right-click the large Macro Voices logo. You may have to scroll down to find the podcasts heading as opposed to the episodes heading. But under podcasts, click on the Macro Voices logo. And then to the right of our logo on the next page, click ratings and reviews. If you've enjoyed Macro Voices, please choose 5 stars just to the right of the words click to rate, and then click the write a review button just below and type in your comments. We really appreciate your donations and your ratings and reviews, and all of us at Macro Voices wish you and yours a safe and happy 2017 holiday season.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.